Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm now joined by Larry Beinhart, who is an award-winning novelist and the author of Salvation Boulevard, just out in paperback. The movie based on this book is now in theaters. His other books include Fog Facts, Searching for the Truth in the Land of Spin, and The Librarian, and Wag the Dog, which was made into a classic film. Welcome to Background Briefing, Larry Beinhart. Are you there, Larry?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Excellent.
So clearly, we've just witnessed some of the most horrific political violence that was a result of religious intolerance, and I think probably a large measure of madness as well. But have you been following the repercussions here from the manifesto that this mass murderer wrote, where he cites a bunch of American bloggers, Muslim-bashing bloggers?
Well, I mean, clearly, you know, if we're going to follow Bush doctrine, the Norwegians, you know, should follow terrorists and invade the countries that harbor them. So, you know, I would expect the Norwegian fleet to show up at our doorstep any minute.
Well, that was one of the clearly, though, the dysfunctional war on terrorism that George Bush launched. First of all, it elevated Bin Laden as an equal.
Launched and lost.
Yes, well, I'm going to say he lost from day one, because he elevated Bin Laden as an equal player on the world stage, compared him to Hitler. And the irony that I find in relationship to this Muslim bashing going on in this country is that if there were such a thing as a war on terror, a war against Islamic extremists, the only people who could win that war would be Islamic moderates, who could moderate the extremists.
Something like that, you know. But I think, you know, it's really important to remember that George Bush launched, in addition to the war on terror, launched two specific wars, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, both of which he failed to win.
Well, the first one was won by the Iranians, by the way.
The first one, we don't know who's going to win yet.
Well, I'd bet on the Iranians, frankly.
Okay. You can bet on the Iranians. You know, we forget that our enemies have their own dysfunctions.
Well, we can only hope. But I mean, the point about I think the there is a sort of zombie presidents here, because still a lot of these concepts are still out there. You've dealt with them in a way I think that is absolutely brilliant in this thriller that you've written, Salvation Army, in which the born again Christian privatized faith is shaken to the core when he takes the case of a Muslim student suspected of killing his atheist professor. Now, the first of all, you're dealing with the two subjects that are verboten in polite conversation in this country, politics and religion.
Yeah, well, they're the most interesting topics, and they're the places where you find the most dead bodies. And that's why I constantly am choosing them. You know, we all woke up one morning early in the 21st century, and it was like we were having a collective bad acid flashback to the 12th century, with Islamic militants ready to martyr themselves just so they could kill infidels, and the leader of the West claiming that he was taking orders from God to invade various countries, and initially at least, and publicly calling his war a crusade. You know, and just like the war to take Jerusalem back under the 12th century popes. And I found this a remarkable series of events. And I also found that nobody was seriously exploring it. Why would people kill and die for what, to an outsider, is clearly fiction? I mean, Looney Tune fiction. And yet, you know, people routinely kill and die for it. They make tons of money from it. And there were no serious answers as to why this product has such sustaining power and why it was making a comeback. Now, So I said, okay, if I want to investigate this and make a living while I'm doing it, I have to do it in the form of a novel.
So do you think, though, that I mean, I get some people, because I come from Australia, they sort of say, oh, yeah, you're descended from convicts, to which I say to Americans, well, you're descended from religious fanatics. I mean, is there a Manichaeism in our DNA? Because remember, we had, for all those decades, the convenient enemy, the Soviets, who were absolutely tailor-made as the enemy. And then that all went away, and there was a period of confusion where a bunch of people in camouflage bumped into each other in the woods looking for enemies, and black helicopters and chips placed in their backsides. And then along comes Islamic terrorism, and now the legislature in Kansas has passing laws against Sharia law, which, frankly, is nowhere on the horizon.
Yeah, Manichaeism, which is, I guess, a name for philosophical binaryism.
Right, where your God is defined by the devil.
Yeah, the truth is that is a real fundamental of human psychology and of necessity. That is to say, the purpose of our minds is to make decisions. And all decisions are essentially yes, no. Yes, it's food. No, it's not. You're a friend. You're an enemy. I'm going to fight. I'm going to flee. I'm going to have sex. I'm going to leave it alone. I'm going to jump off the cliff. I'm going to stay on the edge. So, you know, that kind of thinking is in our structure. Now, the question is, when is it functional thinking? When is it dysfunctional thinking? How do we moderate it? So there's a certain place, clearly, that religion is functional. It makes people feel better. In a lot of people, it improves their health. It's an organizing principle where people can get together and socialize and support each other. It's one of the foundations of our civil rights movement. It has lots of utilitarian qualities. On the other hand, the exact same philosophy and theology can be used for slavery, oppression, in support of horrific regimes, as an excuse to commit mass murder, as a reason to kill yourself. So it's not religion per se that's the issue. It's not Manichaean thinking per se that's the issue. It's where do they come from in our biology and in our social history, and how do we take what's good in them and moderate what's bad in them? Because we can no more eradicate religion than you can eradicate alcohol or marijuana use.
Well, but Larry Beinhart, I suppose it, in a way, it gets down to the terrible fact that that hate is easier than love and death is easier than life.
Is it?
Well, I think for a lot of people it is.
Well, for some people it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you'd like to be able to say, well, if that's the way you feel about it, you know, why don't you find some like-minded people who feel about it that way and leave the rest of us alone?
Good luck. Well, I mean,
wouldn't it be great if you could take, say, Osama bin, well, he's dead now, but, you know, Osama bin Laden's 34th number two guy, whichever one we haven't killed yet, right, and put him in an arena with George Bush and Dick Cheney and let them bash it out?
Well, I'd buy tickets to that event.
Yeah, wouldn't you?
Let me remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Larry Beinhart, the author of Salvation Boulevard, just out in paperback. There's also a movie of it out at the moment in theaters. This is a wonderful religious thriller, if you will, a religious legal thriller, in which Ahmed Nazami, a Muslim scholarship student at the University of confesses under duress to the murder of Nathaniel McLeod, an atheist philosophy professor, and a PI, Carl Van Wagener, a born-again Christian, agrees to help Manny Goldfarb, a celebrated Jewish defense lawyer, prove that Nazimi's innocence. And Van Wagener is a member of the charismatic church of this charismatic pastor, Paul Plow, writes Cathedral of the Third Millennium, and they're all suddenly and soon on the trail of a missing manuscript, which McLeod wrote, disproving God's existence. I mean, frankly, I noticed Vince Bugliosi gave you a blurb. I interviewed him recently. It sounds a bit like Vince, right? He's written The Divinity of Doubt. He's written that very manuscript, which I guess in your case is a MacGuffin, right?
No, I mean, it is and it isn't. In order to have that character, I had to write, you know, figure out what he would have said.
Uh-huh.
I've never actually, you know, I was raised on George Bernard Shaw. And whenever he had a character who wrote a book, it only happened a couple of times, he then attached at the end of the play the book the character wrote.
Hmm.
So the professor's book kind of exists. It's mostly in my computer, and there's enough fragments of it in the novel that you know what he's saying.
Right. Well, that's a tough thing to do, though. And you have to write a philosophical tract.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, to me, there's a job, and the job is to write an entertaining page-turning book.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there are moments when that is a great deal of fun, but. What gets my juices flowing and what makes me want to write the book is the opportunity to explore ideas that I don't find the answer to elsewhere. Or, Wag the Dog. I was watching Gulf War I on television, and I made a joke, this is a made-for-TV movie. And nobody quite laughed, so I made the joke bigger. But it was a chance to explore the notion of creating war, or in the case of the movie, the illusion of war, for the purposes of domestic political propaganda, where people create wars in order to be elected or get reelected. And once you start looking at that, you discover in our recent history, certainly, it's happened a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually, ironically, it didn't happen for the prosecutor of the first war, Bush Sr. He got huge ratings, and then shortly thereafter was defeated.
Yeah, he mistimed it.
But the other guy, the junior, very, very clearly went to war for political gain.
Really? So did Bush 1. Senator Bush won.
Yeah.
I mean, they watched Thatcher, and Thatcher was dead in the water, you should pardon the expression, until she had the Falklands War. And suddenly her political life was revived, and she went on to be the longest-serving British prime minister in modern history because she had a good war. And then Reagan decided to try it out, you know, but it was after Bush one saw Maggie Thatcher in the Falklands,
mm-hmm,
that they decided to have the Iraq War. But if you go back further, you have Lyndon Johnson unable to get out of Vietnam. Because he's certain that if he does, he will lose re-election, or Hubert Humphrey will lose the election, which he does. And then Nixon comes into office, and it looks like, I haven't written about this for a long time, but Johnson is negotiating. And the war in Vietnam. And Nixon reaches out and contacts the South Vietnamese and tells them, if you don't go along with this and you keep the war going, I'll get you a better deal afterward.
Well, specifically there, Larry, that was, I believe, Henry Kissinger using the good offices of Madam Chiang Kai-shek.
Right. So you have the notion of people having wars. And
by the way, what you just described is treason. It is treason.
Treason. It's mass murder.
It's treason for a government in waiting to sabotage a government in office.
It's about as provable as you can get without having a trial that's what happened. There doesn't seem to be much dispute about it. And then once Nixon's in office, they have the terms for the Paris peace talks, and then they decide, you know what, we can't do it until after we're reelected.
Well, he already got a trial at Watergate. We can't try him now. We've run out of time, Larry. I thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Larry Beinhart, the award-winning novelist and author of Salvation Boulevard, just out in paperback. The movie's also out now. He's also did Wag the Dog, which was made into a classic film. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.